that occurred half an hour to an hour ago on the subject of Israel. You know, it's funny. I like Guy a lot. He and I have met a few times in Washington, D.C., and he's a really good guy, and we do see eye to eye on 95% of things. But it is true. We do not see eye to eye on Israel, and I've never quite understood that. I think he and I need, a good six-hour conversation off the air to really, really understand where he's coming from, because I have to admit I have a hard time understanding where those that are critical, let's say, of AIPAC, where they're coming from. I don't get it. I mean, it's one thing to disagree with Israel's policies. That's fine. Every American, every Israeli certainly can disagree with their government's policies. That makes perfect sense. That happens all the time. But when you argue against a lobbying group that doesn't actually pay anybody, as I pointed out, I think to Guy's surprise, it's not a political action committee; it's a public affairs committee. They don't pay politicians. They don't give to politicians campaigns. But the only thing they do, and you can criticize them for if you want, is they take politicians on trips to Israel. But unlike Jack Abramoff's trips to Scotland with Tom DeLay, these are not for golfing trips. These are to show American legislators how narrow, how tiny, how small Israel really is. And yes, there is the famous helicopter trip, the one that George Bush mentions that Sharon took him on, the one Obama mentioned in his recent speech to AIPAC that the Israeli Defense Forces took him on, the one that, yes, Israel takes every politician on. Because I think politicians are shocked when they realize how tiny Israel is. Without the West Bank, Israel is 8 miles wide, maybe 9, at the point of its greatest infrastructure, where its population is. 9 miles wide from the sea to the West Bank. So you get up in a helicopter, and there's the sea, and there's the West Bank. It's right there. I mean, 9 miles is not a lot of territory to break Israel in two. And for all the discussions about Israel and Arab rights, which I believe in, and discussions of what should happen with the territories, and I do support an additional Palestinian Arab state. I think there should be one there. What I think AIPAC does is it makes very clear to American politicians how precarious Israel's position is. And I guess that's the heart of where Guy and I differ. Guy sees Israel as safe and as secure as the United States or France or England. I think he said something like the third strongest military in the world. Israel would be lucky to have a military that strong. I'm sure it's not. Not even close. People don't even realize. I've asked people, to guess the size of various countries in the Middle East. Most people don't realize that, for example, Afghanistan is about the size of California. I need to double check this. As I recall, Afghanistan is the size of Texas. Afghanistan is the size of Texas. Iraq is the size of California. And Israel is the size of New Jersey. There are counties in California that are three times the size of Israel. It's a very, very tiny territory. And so for all the discussion of, Israel should give up this territory or that territory or this blade of grass or that hill or something, people need to understand that the Arabs do have territory that is three times the size of the United States, and Israel has territory that is slightly smaller than New Jersey and is actually much, much thinner, because New Jersey is never 9 miles wide. I mean, 9 miles wide is very thin. So in essence, I think the difference is between people. And I hope Guy will go to Israel someday. I really hope that Guy will take the chance to go to Israel someday. And go there and talk with everyone, talk with Jews, talk with Arabs, talk with Palestinians in the territories, talk with everybody, and see what a tiny country it is. Because the one thing I'm sure of is that at least two-thirds of Israelis, probably more, but at least two-thirds of that democracy would love to have peace with the Arabs, and will give up vast swaths of territory, including territory that would make Israel, again, 9 miles wide, to the Arabs if they believed that they could get peace. And the problem is that ever since Israel has existed, there have always been, at every point, including let's face it, decades before Israel existed. There have always been very powerful Arab states, Arab actors, sometimes European actors, who are determined to wipe Israel off the face of the earth. Ahmadinejad is nothing new at all. He's merely the latest incarnation, merely the greatest threat. From the time of Israel's existence, indeed before its existence, there have always been Arabs who wanted to make sure that Jews could not return home to Judea. And I think at the end of the day, that's where we disagree. You know, Guy was talking about, and this debate will continue. I hope Guy's listening, and he and I can go at this further in the future. Guy was talking about, you know, will America really suffer if Israel doesn't exist? And we mostly talked in military terms. But at the end of the day, I don't think support of Israel is about military things any more than I think support of England or France in World War II was about military things. We didn't support England and France out of military needs. At least I don't think so. I hope not. I hope that wasn't the reason that on D-Day we lost tens of thousands of American lives as the general shouted, "Lafayette, we are here," reminding Lafayette, who helped our troops again in our revolution. No, I think we understood that England and France shared our values, and Nazi Germany did not. At the end of the day, I think Israel shares our values more than those who seek to destroy it. That doesn't mean that Israel is free from condemnation or criticism. I welcome anyone who criticizes the government of Israel for this, that, or the other. You can talk about treatment of this, that, or the other. That's all fair. But when you start questioning, I don't know, Israel's existence as the people in Iran do, that's where I draw the line. So, in any case, a lot of people questioned why it was that Obama, the day after winning the nomination, was appearing at the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee at AIPAC, along with Hillary Clinton and John McCain. And I wanted to play for you a speech that he gave at AIPAC, because I think sometimes Obama can put better than I can the reason why we support Israel. Now, obviously, Jews support Israel because, let's face it, Israel is our best hope for repeating a second Holocaust. That's how many Jews look at Israel, that if it were not for Israel's existence, there could well be a second Holocaust in many countries on earth. After all, when the Arabs kicked out all those Jewish Arabs, or Arab Jews, whatever you want to call them, from Iraq and from Egypt and from Syria and from Iran and all those countries, they would have had no place to go if Israel hadn't existed. But I think Obama gives some very strong strategic reasons, and Bob Kincaid in the private chat room has given another one, which is very, very important and is very clear, and it is religion. There is no question that a large support of Israel is based on Christians, believing Christians, and not just conservative Christians, liberal Christians too, but who recognize that the land of the Bible has special meaning to them and that Jesus has special meaning to them, and they recognize that Jesus was a nice Jewish boy who lived in the land of Israel, and they want to keep Israel safe for future generations. I do want to play for you Obama's speech and a comment on it. Before I get there, though, I just want to talk a little bit about some of the things that I heard from Ambassador Peck on Guy James' show that I didn't really get to. I was responding to Guy's questions, but there were a number of things he said that troubled me. And I guess the first thing that troubled me was complaining about the AIPAC lobby. Now, you know, complaining about a lobby is, I think, it's too much and it's too little. It's too much in the sense that if you're complaining about a lobby, that's not really fair. Every American has the right to petition their government under the First Amendment, whether you agree with them or not. It's too much to criticize the Americans lobbying their government. I mean, what are you criticizing? You're not criticizing the First Amendment, are you? And it's too little. Because if you disagree with what AIPAC is standing for, if you disagree with what they're calling for, then you should give a reason. Say, I disagree with giving money to Israel for its defense. Okay. I disagree with Israel's separation wall. Okay. That at least is an argument. But just arguing against the lobby, to me, it's just not, it's neither here nor there. It's not really fair. You know, there are people who complain about the NRA, the National Rifle Association, and their extreme power in Congress. I'm not so much one of them, I don't think. I tend to complain about what the NRA stands for. I don't like that the NRA wants cop killer bullets. I don't like that the NRA wants to allow crazy people to buy guns. I don't like that the NRA supports a gun show loophole that allows people who could otherwise not buy guns because they're criminals to buy guns anyway. I'm condemning what the NRA stands for, and that I think is perfectly fair. NRA has a right to free speech. They have a right to gather up people. They have a right to get money. They have a right to give it to our candidates, though I support public financing. So I think that instead of complaining about the NRA, the better way to do it is to say the NRA supports this and I disagree and this is why. Similarly, if you don't support Israeli policy on this, that, or the other, or you don't support something AIPAC does on this, that, or the other, I would feel better, and I think I think it's fairer to condemn AIPAC for what they stand for rather than for the fact that Americans are getting together and lobbying. Because when Ambassador Peck complains that those who condemn AIPAC are being called anti-Semitic, well, I think he needs to give the critics a point. If you want to disagree with a lobby, complain about the lobby. But if you want to disagree that Jews and Jews alone should have a right to petition their government for grievances, well, isn't that the definition of anti-Semitism? All I'm saying is, you don't like AIPAC? Fine. Say, AIPAC said this, I disagree. But don't condemn Americans who are busy lobbying their government for whatever they want. Again, I disagree with the pro-life activists, but I don't take away their ability to lobby their government any more than the pro-choice activists or the gun control advocates. The other thing that the ambassador mentioned that I take issue with is when he talked about Jimmy Carter talking with Hamas and saying that really he was trying to help the United States and he was trying to help Israel. And I think it's important for Americans to understand how Israel views Hamas. If Jimmy Carter went to talk to Osama bin Laden and met him in a cave somewhere and didn't tell Americans where he was, and talked with Osama bin Laden about Osama bin Laden's grievances against the United States and how we could best persuade Osama bin Laden not to hate the United States anymore. If Jimmy Carter did this, I would hope he would get as much or far more vitriol directed at him as he did for meeting with Hamas. And yes, I compare Hamas to Osama bin Laden. I don't feel the same way about the government of Iran. Now, you might argue, well, it's kind of the same difference. They're both very dangerous. Ahmadinejad has called basically for a second Holocaust, as Hamas has. But the difference, I think, is that when you have a leader of a country, not a leader of a terrorist group, but when you have a leader of a functioning state, even if that leader is dangerous, sometimes you have to negotiate with them. This is what Obama, I think, says so clearly. This is what, after all, we did with the Soviet Union, what we did with China, what we should do with Cuba. That is not to say give in to them. One of the things I really liked about Obama's speech before AIPAC is he made very clear what and under what conditions he would talk to Iran, to the leaders of Iran. But there's a big difference between that and a terrorist group that just goes around killing people, like Osama bin Laden does. So I consider that very different. Other things, and I want to get to Obama's speech, so I don't want to talk too long, but separation fence, you know, every nation has a right to protect its borders. I don't see that. It's ridiculous to call Gaza or the West Bank a prison any more than calling Nazi Germany a prison because France built a wall on its border. Look, if a country is shooting missiles into another country or sending suicide bombers into another country and that country defends itself and you complain about the defense rather than the attacks, it just doesn't make any sense to me. So I could go on and on, but I do want you to listen to Obama because maybe you'll trust him more than me on this issue. I think he hit exactly the right notes at his speech. I was very proud of where he went and what he had to say because I think that Obama understands not just the military way that Israel helps the United States, but really the close connection between America and Israel. the full, I don't know, the you can call it religious, you can call it an understanding of democracies, you can call it just sort of appreciating people that are under attack. And Obama got it. And at the same time, he didn't in any way neglect the rights of Palestinian Arabs. He talked about them. He talked about having a second state there, things that I support, things that most Israelis support. But at the same time, he recognized that there's a difference between a democratic ally and a bunch of people that are seeking to destroy it. There is a difference between a country under siege, trying to do its best to prevent attacks, and, people who frankly, if they would just stop the attacks, would have had a state a long time ago. Let me get right to Obama's speech and play some of it for you.
Thank you so much. It is great to see so many good friends from all across the country. I want to congratulate Howard Friedman, David Victor, and Howard...
I'll skip past the thank yous and get right to the heart of it.
We had an eventful night last night. And my staff and I may still be a little bleary-eyed, but we have a number of supporters in this room, and we're very grateful to them. And I also want to acknowledge that following my speech, I know that you are going to have the great pleasure of hearing from an extraordinary candidate and an extraordinary public servant, and I want to publicly acknowledge Hillary Clinton for the outstanding race that she has run. She is a true friend of Israel. She is a great senator from New York. She is an extraordinary leader of the Democratic Party, and she has made history alongside me over the last 16 months. So I'm very proud to have competed against her. Before I begin, I also want to mention that I know some have been receiving provocative emails that have been circulated throughout the Jewish communities across the country, and a few of you may have gotten them. They're filled with tall tales and dire warnings about a certain candidate for president, and all I want to say is let me know if you see this guy named Barack Obama, because he sounds pretty scary. But if anybody's been confused by these emails, I want you to know that today I will be speaking from my heart and as a true friend of Israel.
I don't know if any of you have seen the emails to which he refers. I certainly have, and they're certainly convincing a lot of people. Obama is definitely someone for whom a lot of Jews are very worried about. I'm not worried about him at all, and I think this speech makes clear why I'm not. But there are definitely Republicans who are putting out a lot of really harsh stuff against him, a lot of it completely false, such as, you know, Muslim and things like that. In some of it, simply taking Obama's policy positions, such as the fact that he's willing to talk to our enemies, and making it seem like Obama doesn't understand that they are our enemies. Here he is. He continues.
And I know that when I visit AIPAC, I'm among friends, good friends. Friends who share my strong commitment to make sure that the bond between the United States and Israel is unbreakable today, unbreakable tomorrow, unbreakable forever. One of the many things that I admire about AIPAC is that you fight for this common cause from the bottom up. The lifeblood of AIPAC is here in this room. Grassroots activists of all ages, from all parts of the country, who come to Washington year after year to make your voices heard. Nothing reflects the face of AIPAC more than the 1,200 students who have traveled here to make it clear to the world that the bond between Israel and the United States is rooted in more than our shared national interests. It's rooted in the shared values and shared stories of our people. And as president, I will work with you to ensure that it is this bond that is strengthened. You know, I first became familiar with the story of Israel when I was 11 years old. I had a camp counselor who was an American Jew, but had lived in Israel for a time. And he told me stories of this extraordinary land. And I learned of the long journey and steady determination of the Jewish people to preserve their identity through faith, family, and culture. Year after year, century after century, Jews carried on their traditions and their dreams of a homeland in the face of impossible odds. The story made a powerful impression on me. I had grown up without a sense of roots. My father was black. He was from Kenya. He had left when I was two. My mother was white, and she was from Kansas, and I'd moved with her to Indonesia and then back to Hawaii, and in many ways, I didn't know where I came from. So I was drawn to the belief that you could sustain a spiritual, emotional, and cultural identity. And I understood the Zionist idea that there is always a homeland at the center of our story. And I also... learned about the horror of the Holocaust and the terrible urgency it brought to the journey home to Israel. For much of my childhood, I lived with my grandparents. My grandfather had served in World War II, and so had my great uncle. He was a Kansas boy who probably never expected to see Europe, let alone the horrors that awaited him there. And for months after he came home from Germany, he remained in a state of shock, alone with the painful memories that wouldn't leave his head. You see, my great uncle had been part of the 89th Infantry Division, the first Americans to reach a Nazi concentration camp. They liberated Ohrdruf, part of Buchenwald, on an April day in 1945. The horrors of that camp go beyond our capacity to imagine. Tens of thousands died of hunger, torture, disease, or plain murder, part of the Nazi killing machine that killed 6 million people. When the Americans marched in, they discovered huge piles of dead bodies and starving survivors. General Eisenhower ordered Germans from the nearby towns to tour the camp. They could see what was being done in their name. He ordered American troops to tour the camp so they could see the evil they were fighting against. He invited congressmen and journalists to bear witness, and he ordered that photographs and films be made. Explaining his actions, Eisenhower said he wanted to produce first-hand evidence of these things. If ever in the future there develops a tendency to charge these allegations merely to propaganda. I saw some of those very images at Yad Vashem, and they never leave you. And those images just hint at the stories that survivors of the Shoah carry with them. Like Eisenhower, each of us bears witness to anyone and everyone who would deny these unspeakable crimes or ever speak of repeating them. We must mean what we say when we speak the words, never again. It was just a few years after the liberation of the camps that David Ben-Gurion declared the founding of the Jewish State of Israel. We know that the establishment of Israel was just and necessary, rooted in centuries of struggle and decades of patient work. But 60 years later, we know that we cannot relent, we cannot yield, and as president, I will never compromise when it comes to Israel's security.
Let me just say this. I think Obama makes an important point. And some might say, well, why is he going all the way back to the Holocaust? It's not just because it's 60 years that Israel has been a state. But without Israel, there would be no place for the survivors to go. There would be no place for the Jews kicked out of Arab lands to go. They simply had no place to go. If you've ever looked at movies or dramatizations or documentaries of that time, of the ships of tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people desperately trying to find any country on earth that would take them. And Great Britain, for example, as they went to the Jewish state, the homeland that was set aside by Britain and the League of Nations and international law to be a Jewish state, Palestine, and they turned those Jews back and gave them to Germans to put in gas chambers. You know, Great Britain, I love English people today. I do. But what they did in that time period is horrific, truly horrific. And, of course, America wasn't much better. As much as FDR was a terrific president, we were also turning away people back to the death camps. And so I would hope that it'd be a lesson that we never turn away people who are fleeing here for their lives. It's one thing to turn away people who are here for economic advantage. You know, the Mexicans that are coming to our country, and I support their coming to our country for economic advantage. But when we leave Iraq, and we will leave Iraq, there may be a number of Iraqis and others that are fleeing to America for their lives. And we must always, always open our doors to them. I just want to point out, because I think Obama is right to bring up Israel's history. Whatever you agree or disagree with Israel's policy, Israel needs to continue in the Middle East. And that's the thing that I think most Arabs, and certainly the ones that control Arab states, just don't get. It's not about the borders of Israel. We can argue about those. Israel can negotiate about those. It's about an existential right to be there. That is the heart, I think, of the conflict in the Middle East. Let's hear more from Obama.
Not when there are still voices that deny the Holocaust. Not when there are terrorist groups and political leaders committed to Israel's destruction. Not when there are maps across the Middle East that don't even acknowledge Israel's existence and government-funded textbooks filled with hatred towards Jews. Not when there are rockets raining down on Sderot and Israeli children have to take a deep breath and summon uncommon courage every time they board a bus or walk to school. I have long understood Israel's quest for peace and need for security. But never more so than during the travels that Lee referred to 2 years ago when I went to Israel. Flying in an IDF helicopter, I saw a narrow, beautiful strip of land nestled against the Mediterranean. On the ground, I met a family who saw their house destroyed by a Katyusha rocket. I spoke to Israeli troops who faced daily threats as they maintained security near the blue line. I talked to people who wanted nothing more simple or more elusive than a secure future for their children. I have been proud to be a part of a strong bipartisan consensus that has stood by Israel in the face of all threats. That is a commitment. That is a commitment that both John McCain and I share, because support for Israel in this country goes beyond party. But part of our commitment must be speaking up when Israel's security is at risk. And I don't think any of us can be satisfied that America's recent foreign policy has made Israel more secure. Hamas now controls Gaza. Hezbollah has tightened its grip on southern Lebanon, and it's flexing its muscles in Beirut. Because of the war in Iraq, Iran, which always posed a greater threat to Israel than Iraq, is emboldened and poses the greatest strategic challenge to the United States and Israel in the Middle East in a generation. Iraq is unstable, and Al-Qaeda has stepped up its recruitment. Israel's quest for peace with its neighbors has stalled, despite the heavy burdens borne by the Israeli people. And America is more isolated in the region, reducing our strength and jeopardizing Israel's safety. The question is how to move forward. There are those who would continue and intensify this failed status quo, ignoring 8 years of accumulated evidence that our foreign policy is dangerously flawed. And then there are those who would lay all the problems of the Middle East at the doorstep of Israel and its supporters, as if the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is the root of all trouble in the region. These voices blame the Middle East's only democracy for the region's extremism. They offer the false promise that abandoning a stalwart ally is somehow the path to strength. It is not. It has never been, and it never will be. Our alliance is based on shared interests and shared values. Those who threaten Israel threaten us. Israel has always faced these threats on the front lines, and I will bring to the White House an unshakable commitment to Israel's security. That starts with ensuring Israel's qualitative military advantage. I will ensure that Israel can defend itself from any threat, from Gaza to Tehran. Defense cooperation between the United States and Israel is a model of success, and it must be deepened. As President, I will implement a memorandum of understanding that provides $30 billion in assistance to Israel over the next decade, investments to Israel's security that will not be tied to any other nation. First, we must approve the foreign aid request for 2009, and I understand that Speaker Pelosi and Senator Reid are ready to move on that. Going forward, we can enhance our cooperation on missile defense. We should export military equipment to our ally Israel under the same guidelines as NATO, and I will always stand up for Israel's right to defend itself in the United Nations and around the world. Across the political spectrum, Israelis understand that real security can only come through lasting peace. And that is why we, as friends of Israel, must resolve to do all we can to help Israel and its neighbors to achieve it. Because a secure, lasting peace is in Israel's national interest. It is in America's national interest. And it is in the interest of the Palestinian people and the Arab world. As President, I will work to help Israel achieve the goal of two states, a Jewish state of Israel and a Palestinian state, living side by side in peace and security. And I won't wait until the waning days of my presidency. I will take an active role and make a personal commitment to do all I can to advance the cause of peace from the start of my administration.
Of course, here he's referring to the fact that George Bush is waiting till the very end of his administration. He's going to try it from the very beginning.
Now, the long road to peace requires Palestinian partners committed to making this journey. We must isolate Hamas unless and until they renounce terrorism, recognize Israel's right to exist, and abide by past agreements. There is no room at the negotiating table for terrorist organizations. That is why I oppose holding elections in 2006 with Hamas on the ballot. The Israelis and the Palestinian Authority warned us at the time against holding these elections. But this administration pressed ahead, and the result is a Gaza controlled by Hamas, with rockets raining down on Israel. The Palestinian people must understand that progress will not come through the false prophets of extremism or the corrupt use of foreign aid. The United States and the international community must stand by Palestinians who are committed to cracking down on terror and carrying the burden of peacemaking.
Let me just stop it right here and make a really important point that those that claim that Bush is too close to Israel and Obama is too anti-Israel, here Obama points out how he is more pro-Israel than Bush. Bush supported putting Hamas, which is a terrorist organization. It's a terrorist organization not because it opposes Fatah, but because it wants to wipe Israel off the map. Nasrallah, its leader, has talked about killing Jews not just in Israel, but worldwide. His goal is a second Holocaust. That is a terrorist organization. No matter how much he helps Palestinians on the side, his goal is to kill every Jew. That's a problem. Just as no matter how much Farrakhan does good for some blacks, he has an anti-Semitic tendency, so much more so Hamas, which no matter what it does for the Palestinians, is actively trying to destroy Israel. Now, his point is that you should only have on the ballot people who are willing to live in peace with their neighbors. You know, Hitler was on the ballot as well, and that didn't work out too well. When you have terrorist groups, groups that believe in dictatorship and they're elected, they often take democracies and turn them into dictatorships. That's what Hitler did, in fact. He was elected into his position in Germany. He was chosen by an elected president to be chancellor. Then he burned the Reichstag and ended elections in Germany. Hamas has done the same thing. They were brought in with 43% of the vote, a plurality, to get into power to begin with, and then they took over. They banned opposing parties. They banned Fatah. And, of course, they've been sending missiles into Israel ever since. The important thing here is that here you have Obama being stronger on foreign policy against Hamas than even George Bush. So when John McCain says that, oh, well, Hamas endorses Obama, ask John McCain, well, now, Hamas, he gets more support from Bush than from Obama. Don't you think they like Bush? It's an important point. Let's move on.
I will strongly urge Arab governments to take steps to normalize relations with Israel and to fulfill their responsibility to pressure extremists and provide real support for President Abbas and Prime Minister Fayyad. Egypt must cut off the smuggling of weapons into Gaza. And Israel can also advance the cause of peace by taking appropriate steps consistent with its security to ease the freedom of movement for Palestinians, improve economic conditions in the West Bank, and to refrain from building new settlements, as it agreed to do with the Bush administration at Annapolis. Now, let me be clear.
Now, this is interesting. One of the things I like about Barack Obama is he's willing to tell an audience who disagrees with him what he believes. He said that Israel shouldn't build any new settlements to AIPAC. That is something that, I don't know, it's remarkable. Whenever you have a politician tell a group something that they may not agree with, I give him credit for that.
Be clear, Israel's security is sacrosanct. It is non-negotiable. The Palestinians need a state. The Palestinians need a state that is contiguous and cohesive, and that allows them to prosper, but any agreement with the Palestinian people must preserve Israel's identity as a Jewish state with secure, recognized, defensible borders. And Jerusalem will remain the capital of Israel, and it must remain undivided.
Now, that was a very, very strong point that Obama makes. First of all, that Israel must exist as a Jewish state. There are a number of Arabs that believe that if you move enough Arabs into Israel, that because Israel's a democracy, they'll have a majority, and then they can basically vote out the Jewish state and then make sure that the Jews are treated the way that they were always treated in Arab lands, as a second-class citizen, as a minority, under the Dahimi laws that are Sharia laws. They also treat Christians as second-class citizens, too. And they all they have to do is move a whole bunch of people in. That's what the so-called, quote, right of return is about. Well, Obama makes clear that Israel should exist as a Jewish state, and then he goes further. Jerusalem will remain the capital of Israel, and it must remain undivided. And that's actually further than George Bush has gone, and it just makes me like Obama even more. Look, I agree with giving back large swaths of the West Bank, 95-96% of it, but Jerusalem is something special. Jerusalem is, let me make clear to you, more meaningful to Jews than, oh, Mecca to Muslims or Rome to Catholics. And if you just look at the fact that, well, I don't know, Muslims have been praying to Mecca for since 700, about 1,300 years. Jews have been praying to Jerusalem for about three times that time, and longer than Christians have looked to Vatican City and Rome. I've never understood the idea that Jerusalem, of all cities, should not be controlled by Israel. I just don't get it. Obviously, Arabs have rights to live there as a minority, just as you have Jews and Muslims living in Rome. In Mecca, you don't even have Jews and Christians. In fact, they're kicked out of the entire city. But to say, in effect, that the holiest city in Jerusalem, which, by the way, has had more Jews in it than Muslims or Christians since the earliest census taken, the earliest modern census was in 1840, and even then there were more Jews in Jerusalem than Muslims or Christians. Jerusalem has always been the holiest Jewish city. The Temple Mount has always been the holiest Jewish place. And unless we're going to split up Rome and split up Mecca, I think it's perfectly fair for Jerusalem to remain under Israel's control, undivided. Now, if you want to take some suburb of Jerusalem that is an Arab suburb, and you know the Palestinians want to call that Jerusalem and make that the capital of their state, that's fine with me. That's fine with me. And certainly every resident of Jerusalem should have full democratic rights, rights to vote, both in municipal elections and in Israeli elections. But I really appreciated where Barack Obama went here, and this is something I think that will very much help him in the November election.
Now, I have no illusions that any of this will be easy. It will require difficult decisions on both sides. But Israel is strong enough to achieve peace if it has partners who are committed to the goal. Most Israelis and Palestinians want peace, and we must strengthen their hand. The United States must be a strong and consistent partner in this process, not to force concessions, but to help committed partners avoid stalemate and the kind of vacuums that are filled by violence. And that's what I commit to do as President of the United States. The threats to Israel start close to home, but they do not end there. Syria continues its support for terror and meddling in Lebanon. And Syria has taken dangerous steps in pursuit of weapons of mass destruction, which is why Israeli action was entirely justified to end that threat. I also believe that the United States has a responsibility to support Israel's effort to renew peace talks with the Syrians. We must never force Israel to the negotiating table, but neither should we ever block negotiations when Israeli leaders decide that they may serve Israeli interests. As president, I will do whatever I can to help Israel succeed in these negotiations. And success will require the full enforcement of Security Council Resolution 1701 in Lebanon, and a stop to Syria's support for terror. It is time for this reckless behavior to come to an end. Now, There's no greater threat to Israel or to the peace and stability of the region than Iran. This audience is made up of both Republicans and Democrats, and the enemies of Israel should have no doubt that regardless of party, Americans stand shoulder to shoulder in our commitment to Israel's security. So while I don't want to strike too partisan a note here today, I do want to address some willful mischaracterizations of my position. The Iranian regime supports violent extremists and challenges us across the region. It pursues a nuclear capability that could spark a dangerous arms race and raise the prospect of a transfer of nuclear know-how to terrorists. Its president denies the Holocaust and threatens to wipe Israel off the map.
I just want to stop that there. There have been those that argued that Ahmadinejad didn't really say wipe Israel off the map. It's interesting. I just saw him repeat that same quote in Rome. He was there a few weeks ago for the food crisis. I don't know why the United Nations invited a guy like that. It's not like he has any useful solutions for solving the world food crisis. And he said that that Israel will cease to exist, whether Iran causes it or not. It will no longer be on the map. By the way, he also, just to be fair, talked about annihilating the United States too. So it's not just Israel that he seeks annihilation. It's going to be a bit harder for him to annihilate the United States than to Israel. But he does support annihilating us both. Obama makes clear that, yes, this is what the president of Iran has said. And I don't really understand people who are trying to say, well, you know, he just talked about he wants to get rid of Jews in Israel. He wants to get rid of the Zionist regime. It's not that he supports Israel being wiped off the map. He just supports the name Israel being wiped off the map and replacing it with the name Palestine. Well, it's kind of the same thing, don't you think? If you support regime change for a dictatorship, you may well be helping that country come along. But there's a difference between when you support regime change for a democracy, then you just support voting that democracy out. What Ahmadinejad argues is not that there should be Labor or Likud or a different government in Israel. He's arguing that there should be no Jews there. And Obama recognizes that threat. Now, I'm not supporting war with Iran. I don't think it's a good idea at all for us or Israel to attempt to invade Iran. I think that would be a massive, massive, horrible mistake. But at the same time, I think we have to recognize that Iran does pose a danger. And I'm glad that Obama does recognize that.
The danger from Iran is grave, it is real, and my goal will be to eliminate this threat. But just as we are clear-eyed about the threat, we must be clear about the failure of today's policy. We knew in 2002 that Iran supported terrorism. We knew Iran had an illicit nuclear program. We knew Iran posed a great threat to Israel. But instead of pursuing a strategy to address this threat, we ignored it and instead invaded and occupied Iraq. When I opposed the war, I warned that it would fan the flames of extremism in the Middle East. That is precisely what happened in Iran. The hardliners tightened their grip, and Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was elected president in 2005. And the United States and Israel are less secure.
Now, that is a really important point. The invasion of Iraq made Israel less secure. It made Iran stronger. George Bush weakened Israel and helped Iran. John McCain, by keeping all our troops in Iraq, would weaken Israel and help Iran. It's a very, very important point to make to the hardliners, and also to those on the left that argued that Israel supported the invasion of Iraq. I heard that also, the ambassador say to Guy James, and it's dead wrong. As I pointed out to Guy, Israel told America, don't do it. Even the hard right people in Israel, Netanyahu, the hawkish Likud leader, who may well be Israel's next prime minister. I don't know. Olmert's in real trouble with his scandal. But even Netanyahu told the PNACers, the Project for New American Century people, don't do it. It doesn't help Israel. And they did it anyway. So blame Israel for whatever you want that belongs to Israeli government policy. But please don't ever blame Israel for neoconservatives or for the Bush administration's decision to go to war in Iraq. That was solely their foolishness. whether it was Bush, Cheney, and Rumsfeld, or Wolfowitz, and Feith, and Condoleezza Rice, all of them are to blame for that. Just don't blame Israel. It's not their fault. Let's go on with Obama.
I respect Senator McCain, and I look forward to a substantive debate with him these next 5 months. But on this point, we have differed, and we will differ. Senator McCain refuses to understand or acknowledge the failure of the policy he would continue. He criticizes my willingness to use strong diplomacy, but offers only an alternate reality, one where the war in Iraq has somehow put Iran on its heels. The truth is the opposite. Iran has strengthened its position. Iran is now enriching uranium, and it has reportedly stockpiled 150 kilos of low-enriched uranium. Its support for terrorism and threats towards Israel have increased. Those are the facts, and they cannot be denied. And I refuse to continue a policy that has made the United States and Israel less secure. Senator McCain and others offers a false choice: stay the course in Iraq or cede the region to Iran. I reject this logic because there is a better way. Keeping all of our troops tied down indefinitely in Iraq is not the way to weaken Iran. It is precisely what has strengthened it. It is a policy for staying, not a policy for victory. I have proposed a responsible, phased redeployment of our troops from Iraq. We will get out as carefully as we were careless getting in. We will finally pressure Iraq's leaders to take meaningful responsibility for their own future. We will also use all elements of American power to pressure Iran. I will do everything in my power to prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon. Everything in my power to prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon. Everything.
By the way, in the written version of his speech, he doesn't repeat everything three times. I think Obama was making clear, and he's been attacked by this, by those who think he wouldn't keep America strong. He's making clear he would do so. And it's important because I think Obama really is going to reach out to Iran in diplomacy. But diplomacy works, I think, when you have a threat of war in the background. It's exactly the opposite of George Bush. George Bush pretended to do diplomacy with Iraq when he always wanted to invade. I do not think Obama wants to invade Iran. In fact, I'm sure he doesn't. I'm sure he doesn't want to attack Iran. But the threat will make them give better diplomacy. And my hope is that Iran will give up on its silly nuclear ambitions, which really just harm it in the world and make the world a more dangerous place.
That starts with aggressive, principled, tough diplomacy, without self-defeating preconditions, but with a clear-eyed understanding of our interests. We have no time to waste. We cannot unconditionally rule out an approach that could prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon. We have tried limited piecemeal talks while we outsource the sustained work to our European allies. It has not worked. It is time for the United States to lead. Now, there will be careful preparation. We will open up lines of communication, build an agenda, coordinate closely with our allies, especially Israel, and evaluate the potential for progress. And contrary to the claims of some, I have no interest in sitting down with our adversaries just for the sake of talking. But as President of the United States, I would be willing to lead tough and principled diplomacy with the appropriate Iranian leaders at a time and place of my choosing, if and only if it can advance the interests of the United States.
Now, this is an important thing, and Obama's been hit very hard by John McCain for expressing a willingness in a debate a year ago to talk to the Iranian leadership without preconditions. I think Obama's backing off just a little bit, but in a good way. He's making clear that you only talk with your enemies if you have some goal, if you have something that you think can be achieved. You don't do it just to talk. And I welcome this modification, which really I think is all he meant to begin with. It's just that at the beginning he had to answer yes or no. This is going to be an issue in the fall campaign, I guarantee it.
That is my position. I want it to be absolutely clear. Only recently have some come to think that diplomacy by definition cannot be tough. They forget the example of Truman and Kennedy and Reagan. These presidents understood that diplomacy backed by real leverage was a fundamental tool of statecraft. And it is time to once again make American diplomacy a tool to succeed, not just a means of containing failure. We will pursue this diplomacy with no illusions about the Iranian regime. Instead, we will present a clear choice. If you abandon your dangerous nuclear program, your support for terror, and your threats to Israel, there will be meaningful incentives, including the lifting of sanctions and political and economic integration with the international community. If you refuse, we will ratchet up the pressure. My presidency will strengthen our hand as we restore our standing. Our willingness to pursue diplomacy will make it easier to mobilize others to join our cause. If Iran fails to change course when presented with this choice by the United States, it will be clear to the people of Iran and to the world that the Iranian regime is the author of its own isolation. And that will strengthen our hand with Russia and China as we insist on stronger sanctions in the Security Council. And we should work with Europe, Japan, and the Gulf states to find every avenue outside the United Nations to isolate the Iranian regime, from cutting off loan guarantees and expanding financial sanctions to banning the export of refined petroleum to Iran to boycotting firms associated with the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, who Quds forces have rightly been labeled a terrorist organization.
Time is running out, so he's almost at the end of his speech. Let me just sort of tell you what he says at the very end. He talks about the fact that we need to divest from Iran, from companies that do business in Iran. It's a bill with bipartisan support, and he doesn't understand why John McCain didn't sign on. He goes on to say, this, by the way, got him his most sustained applause probably the whole time, that we have to free ourselves from the tyranny of oil, that the price of a barrel of oil, Obama says later on in the speech, is one of the most dangerous weapons in the world. Petrodollars paid for weapons that killed American troops and Israeli citizens, and the Bush administration's policies have driven up the price of oil, while its energy policy has made us more dependent on foreign oil and gas. It is time for the United States to take real steps to end our addiction to oil. And there was a very large clapping there, because he goes on to point out that the surest way to increase our leverage in the long term is to stop bankrolling the Iranian regime. He goes on to say that America will remain a steadfast ally of Israel, recognizing what Israel has accomplished, taking in Jews from all over the world, including, by the way, Ethiopia. A lot of people don't realize that African Jews also live in Israel. And he goes on to talk about the bond between Jews and blacks that existed in the civil rights era that he's always remembered and will always stand there. I thought it was an amazing speech. I was very happy with it. I think it will do amazing things for Obama in the Jewish community and into the larger pro-Israel community. There are a lot of people that support Israel for all kinds of reasons. And look, it's one thing to disagree with some of Israel's policies. That's perfectly fair to do. But in terms of the longstanding American commitment to our ally in Israel, Obama is